Your Eminence, Cardinal Müller, beloved friends, it is an extraordinary privilege to sit in a room of such distinguished company, remarkable individuals. Every one of you has devoted your life to a noble cause. And here we are united momentarily, temporarily, as an extended family to defend, I think, the noblest cause of all, marriage and the family. So I pray, by way of introduction, may God's Spirit rest on us all. May we be enlarged by one another's wisdom, given inspired by one another's insight, and given courage by one another's strength. Amen. Friends, Elie Wiesel once said, God created man because God loves stories. So I thought the simplest thing for me to do today was simply tell the story the way I see it, and we will all be telling the story the way we see it, of, I think, the most beautiful idea in the history of civilization, the idea of the love that brings new life into the world. And I tell it by way of seven critical moments, each one of which was surprising and unexpected. The first, according to a report 4 weeks ago in the press on the 20th of October this year, took place in a lake in Scotland 385 million years ago. It was then, according to this new discovery, that two fish came together to perform the first instance of sexual reproduction known to science. It is now official, sex was invented in Scotland. Once you add that to that single malt whiskey, I think we need nothing else to. Anyway, until then, all life, as we know, had propagated itself asexually by cell division, budding, fragmentation, or parthenogenesis, all of which are far simpler and more economical than the division of life into male and female, each with a different role in creating and sustaining life. Now, when you consider, even in the animal kingdom, how much effort and energy the coming together of male and female actually involves in terms of display, courtship ritual, rivalries, and violence, it is frankly astonishing that sexual reproduction ever happened at all. And biologists still aren't sure quite why it did. Some say to offer protection against parasites, others to generate immunity against disease. But the simplest explanation and the most profound is that it is the meeting of opposites that generates diversity. And I believe, as I've said once before, that the miracle of monotheism is that unity up there creates diversity down here. And all the more so when it comes to the human person by that genetic miracle, which I think was best expressed by Harvard philosopher Hilary Putnam when he said, every child has a right to be a complete surprise to its parents. So one way or another, the fish in Scotland discovered something new and beautiful that's been copied ever since by virtually all advanced forms of life. Life begins when male and female meet and embrace. The second unexpected development was the unique challenge posed to Homo sapiens by two factors. Number one, that we stood upright, which constricted the female pelvis. And number two, we had bigger brains, 300% increase, which meant larger heads. The result was that human babies had to be born more prematurely than any other species, and so needed parental protection for much longer. This made parenting much more demanding among humans than any other species, and the work of two people rather than one. Hence, this unique thing, almost unique thing, very rare thing among mammals of pair bonding. Unlike most other mammalian species where the male contribution tends to end with the act of impregnation, amongst most primates, fathers don't even recognize their children, let alone care for them. So what emerged along with the human person was the union of biological mother and father to care for their child, and thus far, nature. But with Act 3 in the drama, culture begins to appear. It seems that among hunter-gatherers, pair bonding was the norm. Then came agriculture and economic surplus and cities and civilizations. And for the first time, sharp inequalities began to emerge between rich and poor, powerful and powerless. The great ziggurats of Mesopotamia and the pyramids of Egypt were monumental statements in stone of a hierarchical society in which the few had power over the many. And the most obvious expression of power among alpha males, whether they are human or primate, is to dominate access to fertile women and thus maximize the passing on of their genes to the next generation. Hence polygamy, which exists in 95% of mammal species and 75% of cultures known to anthropology. Polygamy is the ultimate expression of inequality because it means that many males never get the chance to have a wife and a child. And sexual envy has been, throughout history, one of the prime drivers of violence. That is what makes the first chapter of Genesis so revolutionary, with its statement that every human being, regardless of color, culture, creed, or class, is in the image and likeness of God himself. We know that in the ancient world, it was rulers, emperors, kings, pharaohs who were considered in the image of God. And therefore, what Genesis was saying is that we are all royalty. We each have equal dignity in the kingdom of faith under the sovereignty of God. From this, it follows that we each have an equal right to form a marriage and have children, which is why, regardless of how we read the story of Adam and Eve, and there are differences between Jewish and Christian ways of reading that story, the norm presupposed in that narrative is one woman, one man. As the Bible says, that is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. Now, monogamy didn't immediately become the norm, even in the biblical era itself, but many of its most famous stories, like the tension between Sarah and Hagar, or between Leah and Rachel, or between their children, or David and Bathsheba, or Solomon's many wives, are all critiques that point the way toward monogamy. And there is a deep connection between monotheism and monogamy, just as there is in the opposite direction between idolatry and adultery. Monotheism and monogamy are about the all-embracing relationship between I and thou, myself and one other, be it a human or the divine other. Now, what makes the appearance of monogamy unusual is that it's normally the case that the values of a society are imposed on it by the ruling class. And the ruling class in any hierarchical society stands to gain from promiscuity and polygamy, both of which multiply the chances of the king or the powerful being handed on to the next generation. From monogamy, the rich and powerful lose, the poor and powerless gain. So the return of monogamy goes against the grain of normal social change and was a real triumph for the equal dignity of all. Every bride and every groom are royalty, every home a palace when furnished with love. The fourth remarkable development was the way this transformed the moral life. We all know the work of evolutionary biologists who explain through these wonderful computer simulations of something called the iterated prisoner's dilemma that reciprocal altruism exists among all social animals. We behave to others as we would wish them to behave to us, and we respond to them as they respond to us. C.S. Lewis, in his little book, The Abolition of Man, called this the golden rule shared by all the great civilizations. So that's the principle of fairness or justice. What was new and really remarkable in the Hebrew Bible was the idea that love, not just fairness, is the driving principle of the moral life. Three loves. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. Love your neighbor as yourself. And 36 times repeated in one way or another in the Mosaic books, love the stranger because you know what it feels like to be a stranger. Now, put it another way, just as God created the universe in love and forgiveness, he asks us to create our universe, the social universe, in love and forgiveness. And that love is the flame lit in marriage and the family, so that morality is the love between husband and wife, parent and child, extended outward towards the world. The fifth development shaped the entire structure of the Jewish experience. In ancient Israel, as you know, an originally secular form of agreement called a covenant was taken and transformed into a new way of thinking about the relationship between God and humanity. In the case of Noah, with all humanity, and in the case of Abraham and later the Israelites, with a particular people. A covenant is like a marriage. It is a mutual pledge of loyalty and trust between two or more people, each respecting the dignity and integrity of the other, to achieve together what neither can achieve alone. And there is one thing that even God cannot achieve alone, which is to live within the human heart. That needs us. So the Hebrew word emunah, key word of both Judaism and Christianity, is wrongly translated as faith. It really means faithfulness, fidelity, loyalty, steadfastness, not walking away even when the going gets tough, trusting the other and honoring the other's trust in us. What covenant did, and we see this in almost all the Hebrew prophets, was to understand that the relationship between us and God is like the relationship between bride and groom, wife and husband. Love thus became not only the basis of morality, but also of theology. In Judaism, faith is a marriage. And rarely was this more beautifully stated than by a line Jewish men recite every morn, every weekday morning, those beautiful words of Hosea, where God says, I betroth you to me forever. I betroth you to me in righteousness and justice, love and compassion. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you will know the Lord. And we say those words every weekday morning as we wind the straps of our tefillin, our phylacteries, around our finger, like a wedding ring. In other words, every single day, we renew our marriage with God. The sixth moment, and a very subtle idea, is that if this is really true, then beauty and truth and goodness and even life itself does not exist in any one person or entity, but in the between, in what Martin Buber called, and my German here is really terrible, it's much worse than your English, if I may say so, kind of, so forgive me, really, your English is superb, das zwischen menschliche, no, is
very
that,
good, very good.
Well then
very
I do, thank you,
I like my English,
terrific, so the interpersonal, truth resides in the interpersonal, the counterpoint, the fugue between speaking and listening, giving and receiving. Throughout the Hebrew Bible and the rabbinic literature, the vehicle of truth is conversation. In Revelation, God speaks to us and asks us to listen. In prayer, we speak to God and ask him to listen. There is never only one voice. In the Bible, the prophets argue with God. In the Talmud, the rabbis argue with one another. In fact, I sometimes think the reason God chose the Jewish people because he loves a good argument. So Judaism became a conversation scored for many voices. Never more passionately than in the Song of Songs, which we've heard in that beautiful video at the beginning of the session, which is a duet between a woman and a man, the beloved and her lover. And Rabbi Akiva in the first century called this the Holy of Holies of religious literature. And it's very interesting that the prophet Malachi speaks about the male priest and he calls him the guardian of Torat Emet, the law of truth. The book of Proverbs speaks about the woman of worth, or the woman of strength, and says Torat Chesed, the law of loving kindness, is on her tongue. It is that conversation between the male and female voices, between truth and love, justice and mercy, law and forgiveness, that frames the spiritual life. In biblical times, each Jew had to give half a shekel to the temple. Why? To remind us that we are only half. There are some cultures that teach that we are nothing. There are other cultures that teach that we are everything. But the Jewish view is that we are half, and we need to open ourselves to another if we are to become whole. All this led to the seventh outcome, that in Judaism, the home and the family became the central setting of the life of faith. There's only one verse in the Hebrew Bible which explains why God chose Abraham. It's a very interesting verse. We read it in the synagogue a couple of weeks ago. I have known him so that he will instruct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just. Think of this. Abraham was chosen not to rule an empire, not to command an army, not to perform miracles, not even to deliver prophecies. He was chosen simply to be a parent. And in one of the most famous lines in Judaism, which we say every day and every night, Moses commands, "You shall teach these things repeatedly to your children, speaking them when you sit in your house, when you walk on the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up." In other words, parents must be educators. Education is the conversation between the generations, and the first school is the home. So Jews became an intensely family-oriented people. And it was this that saved us from tragedy. Because after the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70, Jews were scattered throughout the world, everywhere a minority, everywhere without rights, suffering some of the worst persecutions ever known by a people. And yet Jews survived because there were three things they never lost. Number one, their sense of family. Number two, their sense of community. And number three, their faith. And they were renewed every week, especially on Shabbat, on the Sabbath, the day of rest, when we give our marriages and our families what they most need and what they are most starved of in the contemporary world, which is time. I once produced a television documentary for the BBC on the state of the family in Britain. We had something called the International Year of the Family, United Nations thing, and halfway through the year, I said to the BBC, "You've done documentaries on, dozens of documentaries on the family. There's only one you haven't done." They said, "What's that?" I said, "A program that will show that family is a good thing." So they said, "Okay, you make it." So I did. And I will never forget that, because I just wanted to see what would happen. I took Britain's then leading childcare specialist called Penelope Leach, who had never been to a Jewish school, didn't know Jews, and I took her to a Jewish primary school on a Friday morning. Now, what happens in every Jewish primary school on a Friday morning is the kids enact the family ritual that's going to take place on the Friday evening. So there she was watching the five-year-old mummy and daddy blessing the five-year-old children with the five-year-old grandparents watching on. And she loved it. She was absolutely enthralled by it. And she asked the children what they most enjoyed about the Sabbath. And one five-year-old boy said to her, "You know why I enjoy it? Because Shabbat, Friday evening, is the only day of the week when daddy doesn't have to rush off." And as we were leaving the school, she turned to me and said, "Chief Rabbi, that Sabbath of yours is saving their parents' marriages." Now, that is my way of telling the story. It's a Jewish way, beginning with the birth of sexual reproduction, then the unique demands of human parenting, then the eventual triumph of monogamy as the fundamental statement of human equality, then the way marriage shaped our vision of the moral and religious life is based on love and covenant and faithfulness, to even to the point of thinking of truth as a conversation between others, between male and female, between God and us. What then has changed? And here's one way of putting it. A couple of years ago, I wrote a book about religion and science. It's a big book, so I thought nobody's going to have time to read it. I'd better have a two-sentence summary. So here is how I summarize the difference between religion and science. I said science takes things apart to see how they work. Religion puts things together to see what they mean. And that is a very profound difference. And it seems to me that cultures are a bit like that. Does a given culture take things apart, or does it put things together? Now, what made the traditional family remarkable and a work of high religious art is what it brought together. It brought together sexual drive, physical desire, friendship, companionship, emotional kinship, and love, the begetting of children and their protection and care, their early education, their induction into an identity and a history. Seldom has any institution woven together so many different drives and desires, so many different roles and responsibilities. It made sense of the world and gave it a human face, the face of love. For a whole variety of reasons, some to do with medical developments like birth control, in vitro fertilization, and other genetic interventions. Some to do with moral change, like the idea that we're free to do whatever we like so long as it doesn't harm others. Some to do with a transfer of responsibilities from the individual to the state. And other and even more profound changes in the culture of the West. Because of all these things, almost everything that marriage once brought together has now been split apart. So sex has been divorced from love. Love has been divorced from commitment. Marriage has been separated from having children. And having children has been separated from responsibility for their care. The result of this is that in the latest figures in Britain that we have, and those are 2012, in 2012, 47.5% of children in Britain were born outside marriage. And that is expected to become a majority of children in 2016. Fewer people are marrying. They're marrying later. And 42% of marriages in Britain end in divorce. People say cohabitation is an alternative. Well, actually, cohabitation is no substitute for marriage because the average length of cohabitation in Britain is less than 2 years. The result is that who pay the price for this? The children. And the result has been a sharp increase among young people of eating disorders, drug and alcohol abuse, stress-related syndromes, depression, and actual and attempted suicides, God forbid. The collapse of marriage has created a new form of poverty centered on single-parent families. And of those, the main burden is overwhelmingly borne by women, who in 2011 in Britain headed 92% of single-parent households. In Britain today, more than 1 million children will grow up with no contact whatsoever with their fathers. Now, this is creating a divide within societies, the like of which has not been seen since Benjamin Disraeli spoke about two nations a century and a half ago. Those who are privileged to grow up in stable, loving association with the two people who brought them into being will, on average, be healthier physically and emotionally. They will do better at school and at work. They will have more successful relationships. They will be happier and they will live longer. And yes, there are many exceptions. But the injustice of it all, the children who are deprived of these things, cries out to heaven. It will go down in history, the Western abandonment of marriage, as one of the tragic instances of what Friedrich Hayek called the fatal conceit, that somehow we know better than the wisdom of the ages and can defy the lessons of history. No one surely wants to go back to the narrow prejudices of the past. This week in Britain, a new film opens, telling the story of one of the great minds of the 20th century, Alan Turing, who contributed so much to the philosophical foundations of computing and artificial intelligence and helped win the war by breaking the German naval code, the Enigma Code. After the war, Turing was arrested and tried for homosexual behavior, underwent chemically induced castration, and died at the age of 41 by cyanide poisoning, thought by many to have committed suicide. That's the kind of world to which we should never return. But our compassion for those who choose to live differently should not inhibit us from being advocates for the single most humanizing institution in history. The family, man, woman, and child, is not one lifestyle among many. It is the best means we have yet discovered for nurturing future generations, enabling children to grow up in a matrix of stability and love. It's where we learn the delicate choreography of relationship and how to handle the inevitable conflicts within any human group. It is where we first take the risk of giving and receiving love. It's where one generation passes on its values to the next, ensuring the continuity of a civilization. For any society, the family is the crucible of its future. And for the sake of our children's future, we must be its defenders. Now, since this is a religious gathering, let me, if I may, just end with a tiny piece of biblical exegesis. Okay? The story of the first family, the first man and woman in the Garden of Eden, is, am I right in saying, not generally regarded as a success story. Whether or not we believe in original sin, it did not end happily. Now, after years of studying the text very closely, I want to suggest actually a different reading. And here it goes. The story ends with three peculiar verses, three sequential verses that seem to have no connection with one another. No logic, no sequence. Genesis 3, verse 19 says, by the sweat, God says to man, by the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. Then in the next verse we read, the man named his wife Eve, because she was the mother of all life. And the next verse, the Lord God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife, and clothed them. Now what's the connection here? Why did God, telling the man that he was mortal, lead the man to giving his wife a new name? And why did that act seem to change God's attitude to both of them so that he performed an act of tenderness by making them clothes, almost as if he'd partially forgiven them? And let me also add that the Hebrew word for skin, garments of skin, or, is almost indistinguishable for the Hebrew word or, which means light. And so Rabbi Meir, the great sage of the second century, translated it as God robed them in garments of light. Now, what is going on in these three verses? I suggest the following. If we read the text carefully, we'll see that until now, the man had given his wife what name? Purely generic. He called her Isha, woman. That was it. Remember what he said when he first saw her. This is now bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken from man. For him, she was a type. She wasn't a person. He gave her a noun, not a name. What's more, he defines her as derivative of himself, something taken from man. She is not yet for him something other, something complementary, something different, a person in her own right. She's merely a kind of reflection of himself. As long as man thought he was immortal, he ultimately needed no one else. But now he knew he was mortal. He would one day die and return to dust. There was only one way in which something of him would live on after his death. That would be if he had a child. But he couldn't have a child on his own. For that, he needed his wife. She alone could give birth. She alone could mitigate his mortality. And not because she was like him, but precisely because she was unlike him. And at that moment, she ceased to be for him a type and became a person in her own right, and a person has a proper name, and that is what he gave her, the name Chava, Eve, the mother, the giver of life. At that moment, as they were about to leave Eden and face the world as we know it, a place of darkness, Adam gave his wife the first gift of love, a personal name. And at that moment, God responded to them both in love and made them garments to clothe their nakedness, or as Rabbi Meir put it, garments of light. And so it has been ever since, that when a man and woman turn to one another in a bond of faithfulness, God robes them in garments of light. And we come as close as we will ever get to God himself, bringing new life into being, turning the prose of biology into the poetry of the human spirit, and redeeming the darkness of the world by the radiance of love.